last case for the day, 2023-1561, Mahoning County Bar Association versus Brian McCullough. The bench looks a little different right now. Sitting on behalf of Justice Bruner is Judge Ginger Bach of the First District Court of Appeals. Thank you, Judge, for being here today.
Thank you, Chief.
On behalf of the relator, Mr. Thompson. Good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Justices, Your Honor, may it please the court. I'm J. Michael Thompson, Bar Counsel for Relator and Objector, Mahoning County Bar Association. At this time, I would request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We are here today on Relator's objections to the board's report in this case solely on the matter of sanction. This was a fully stipulated case. The respondent, Brian McCullough, stipulated and the board found that he forged the signatures of the fiduciary of two estates and four beneficiaries of one of the estates to waivers of partial accounts and then filed the forged documents with the Mahoning County Probate Court. For this conduct, the board recommends that the court impose a public reprimand. The board thinks that this case is akin to the all too common notary violation cases, including a number of cases of false notarization of real or authorized signatures. The board perceives this case as analogous to that sort of procedural dishonesty. A relator objects because this case is about dishonest conduct of a more substantial kind. In an estate proceeding where the purpose of the proceeding is to give an account, a court was demanding a long overdue partial account. The fiduciary's job was to make that account. The beneficiary's right was to receive that account, and it was late. And someone, the court, the client, the beneficiaries, was going to be unhappy about that. So without the knowledge of any of these five people, including his client, the respondent forged five signatures and then filed the forged waivers with the court. The consequences were greatly mitigated when an heir discovered the forged documents not long thereafter and the respondent was swiftly terminated and replaced. But this is not a notary case, and it should not be a public reprimand. It also, I would like to emphasize, should not result in an actual suspension or a penalty higher than that. A relator is objecting because the appropriate penalty is a 12-month fully stayed suspension. The general principles that we can draw from the case law, and I first, before I even say general principles, I acknowledge that all discipline precedents are imperfect precedents, that every case is unique, but some general principles of guidance can be drawn from the case law in this area. And it starts with Medina County Bar Association versus Cameron, that although an actual suspension from the practice of law is the general sanction when an attorney engages in dishonest conduct, a lesser sanction may be appropriate when the misconduct is an isolated incident in an attorney's career or when little or no harm resulted from the misconduct. And I will acknowledge that this is an isolated incident in respondent's career and that little or no harm resulted from the misconduct. So while this principle of an actual suspension is often stated as the rule, the cases that we briefed on and the cases that are relevant to this case make it more of an exception, that the analysis starts there, but that in cases like this, a fully stayed suspension is appropriate. If I had to sum up Relator's reason for objecting in one sentence, it is that the isolated incident and the lack of harm are what get a respondent to a fully stayed suspension.
So, but if you look at Fowerball, if you are lying to a tribunal, which is you're forging documents and filing them to get out from underneath a contempt hearing, and you're forging those documents to show the court that you're in compliance, why isn't it the presumption of an actual suspension under Fowerball? And then under the line of cases following that, it's really, is there enough mitigation evidence to support not imposing an actual term of suspension?
Yes. And I think that the reason for departure is in the cases that are cited in the 12-month suspension section of my brief. And I think your guidance there for why you depart is that Niemeyer Gibson, and Chodosh, the train of cases that runs through them, and I may get the chance to talk about them in more detail, right there. That's where the justification for departing from the actual suspension lies. For example, Niemeyer is conduct a little more severe of what you just described and what I believe is accurate here. You know, here we have an angry probate court, but there's not going to be a severe consequence. It's a partial account. The estate is complicated. You know, the reason it's been delayed is not neglect. There's no neglect here. Now, in Niemeyer, which I think might be the most precise answer to your question, a workers' comp claim had been filed, and the attorney withdrew it in order to develop medical documentation further, or withdrew it because the view was that the medical documentation was insufficient. But then he failed to timely refile it. I don't know if you call it a statute of limitations in the workers' comp context, but he blew the statute and then falsifies a timely filed document and files it untimely in the workers' comp system. I understand the forgery there was some sort of fake timestamp, and was hoping that the overwhelmed Bureau of Workers' Compensation would not notice the forgery. And judging from the opinion, I think the court believed the Bureau might not have noticed it, that they are that overwhelmed.
So, Counselor, you say, yes, there is reason to deviate down mitigating circumstances from a full suspension, from an actual suspension.
Yes.
But you insist that the case law says this should be a 1 year fully stayed as opposed to 6 months.
I think either would be appropriate, a 6 month or 12 month fully stayed suspension. I believe there is more authority for 12 months, but that 6 months would not be any kind of egregious departure. I think that the important distinction here is between a public reprimand and a fully stayed suspension. I think those distinctions are important, and Relator thinks those distinctions are important, and that the message sending function of the penalty you give when you're not stopping a lawyer from practicing law is important. And to go back to Chief Justice Kennedy's question, Niemeyer's conduct is worse. You know, that's I think by a degree, and yet Niemeyer is a 12-month fully stayed suspension. And then Niemeyer becomes the genesis of a line, well, not the genesis, part of the development of a line of cases involving 12-month suspensions.
But isn't this a Chodosh case, really?
Isn't it a Chodosh case?
Yes.
Yes, it's very similar. I think Chodosh is a great parallel, and Chodosh is also a fully stayed 12-month suspension. You know, the parallels are more exact. You know, when Chief Justice Kennedy raised her issue, you know, Niemeyer's worse. Chodosh is not on all fours. There's no such thing as on all fours. But Chodosh is a great parallel. You have the signing of the name to two checks, the signing of the client's name to a release. It was the client's name on the checks as well. Signing his own name as having witnessed the signature and directing his secretary to notarize the signature. So Chodosh is a great illustration of the distinction. You know, a lot of these cases the board is citing are notarization of authorized signatures. It's astonishing how common that is, actually, the violations that lead to that line of cases. But Chodosh is like that. There's something more in this case than what the public reprimand cases do. And the something more is akin to Chodosh. I mean, I think that your line of reasoning runs from Niemeyer through Gibson to Chodosh. And I think that's absolutely true. Coming back to the reasons why I think this violation is more, I call it substantial rather than procedural, the reason why it justifies a stayed suspension rather than a public reprimand, it includes what this proceeding is. You know, I've already referred to it. You know, in the probate court, an account is one of the most serious things that you do. When a case is dragging on for years, you know, virtually always the participants in a probate proceeding are not people with lots of experience with our system. They're a cross-section, you know, they're the heirs, they're the executors. And so it's important that this accounting be done. It's a meaningful thing to the probate court. And when these signed documents get filed, that says to this court, hey, at this particular moment in time, all of the beneficiaries feel they've been completely informed. The executor feels they've performed their duty in fully informing them. And therefore, it is safe, it is right, Judge, for you to allow this case to go forward a bit longer without a partial account. And this is a system that, from the probate judge's perspective, depends very much on honesty.
How much weight should we put on the fact that there was no harm to the client?
Quite a bit of mitigating weight, absolutely. But the larger point would be that's what gets us to fully stayed territory. It's absolutely mitigating. Now, there are cases where it would be more mitigating. For example, in Niemeyer, Niemeyer becomes overwhelmed with guilt and self-reports conduct which even the court acknowledges may never have been discovered. If you read between the lines in Niemeyer, it's pretty clear the court thinks the Bureau wouldn't have discovered it. Now, it's almost as mitigated here. It's not self-reported, but there's a confrontation. An heir discovers this forged document relatively swiftly. There's a conversation of some kind. There's an indication of understanding. He's terminated. A grievance is filed by one of the heirs.
Did he ever seek to deny?
No.
Okay.
No, never. In the conversation with the
client.
Correct. He acknowledged that the rightfulness of the termination, and when the grievance was sent to him, he immediately admitted the conduct. There's no denial. It's just short of self-reporting, but great mitigating effect for full and free cooperation. There's been absolutely no denial. So going back to the probate judge's perspective, they have to be able to rely that these signatures are real. I mean, that's what I think elevates this away from the public reprimand, is that there's no notarization requirement. You know, it's difficult for probate practitioners and for probate judges, because these people are all inexperienced in the system. Every time you do this, you got to get all these signatures. If there was a notary requirement, it would become even more unwieldy and the probate process might grind to a complete halt. So they have to be able to rely on the honesty of the practitioners in the court. These really are these four signatures. And there's previous documents in the record in this case where they are the real signatures. So you have a court system that peculiarly depends upon honesty, and again, that's another reason. And then in addition, I think the other substantial reason for a departure upward from the board report, but not all the way to an actual suspension, is that we do feel there's two layers of dishonest conduct here. There's dishonesty to the client and dishonesty to the court. You know, a lot of these notary cases, a lot of the cases the board cites, and some of the cases that my learned colleague cites, you know, we're talking about one layer of dishonesty. We're talking in a lot of them, in a majority of them, I believe, real or authorized signatures. You know, even Melnick, which is a strange case. You know, they're real signatures where he did multiple efforts to confirm they were real and yet notarized signatures that he hadn't witnessed. And I see that I'm getting up against the edge of my rebuttal time, so I'll reserve that time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of respondent, Mr. Juhas, I hope I said that correctly.
You did, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Kennedy, good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Juhas. I represent the respondent in this case, Brian McCullough.
Counsel, why was your client fired by the executor? Why was he fired by the executor? If there was no harm.
The son, I think she was just angry about what happened with.
Because he faked her signature.
Yes.
And he faked the signature of the beneficiaries.
Correct.
They weren't happy either.
They were not. And so the son, I believe the son discovered it because he's a lawyer, notified the mother, and the mother, I don't even believe there was a conversation at first. It was simply a letter, you're fired.
So they had to go out and get new counsel.
They did.
So there was damage.
There really wasn't damage, Your Honor, because he didn't take any fees. They were still in the process of collecting and trying to find out the assets. I have to respectfully disagree with my learned brother about the probate court being angry about this. It was a long case and a long estate that they're going through boxes and boxes of material trying to find these things. And I believe the testimony at the hearing is, I went down once and asked for an extension, and the second time, when I wanted to file a motion, the magistrate said, well, just get these waivers signed. And then time ran out, and he panicked.
Is there any question, or was it up for discussion, whether the clients would have signed those waivers?
I don't think so, because the estates were still going at the time of the record hearing on this last October, and there were additional requests for extensions of time. So I don't think that's the issue.
If the executor and the heirs didn't care, why would they have fired him?
I think it was simply the disappointment and outrage about the fact that he had
a lack of trust.
Exactly. And the irony of this is, and we all know that hindsight in these cases and in many facets of life is 20/20. The irony of this is that if he had not filed those waivers with those signatures, I have to respectfully disagree with the characterization that it's an angry probate court. This stuff happens all the time. If the account's not filed, the purpose of this is to keep track of it and make sure the estate's going. If the account's not filed, then they would send a notice out and say, we're going to have a hearing on a citation because you didn't file an account. And in this case, before we got to the record hearing, and in many cases, what happens is that you show up with the account and they go, citation dismissed, and let's move on. And ironically, that's probably what would have happened here. But in terms of harm to the client, we would respectfully disagree that there was any harm to the client because no fees were taken. And for quite some time after new counsel was retained, they were still digging through the things and unable to find to file proper
so
accounts.
So law school, I should teach them. Doesn't matter.
I'm sorry?
At law school, I should teach them. Doesn't matter. You can sign other people's names.
Not saying it doesn't matter. We're not trying to minimize what the conduct is here, but we're also saying that what the board recommended here is not an outlier for false document cases.
The cases the board cites tend to be those where a lawyer calls up and says, you know, I need your signature. Well, I can't get there. Well, I'll sign it, and then it gets it notarized or something. The cases cited tend to be consent cases.
Tend to be, but the Bryant case that we cited to the court and that we cited to the board was not that sort of case. Just signed the client's name in bankruptcy proceeding and filed it with the bankruptcy court as if it were the client's signature. So I would not say that all of the cases were. I will concede that true many of them were. Many of them were the 3.3 violations that we have here and the either 8.4 violations or the antecedent of it, if you go back to older cases. And in all of those cases, there were still public reprimands, which this court upheld, sometimes with little or very short per curiam opinions, so there wasn't like a long discussion about lawyers be warned. In all of the cases, I mean, Mr. Thompson says that the probate court has a right to rely on it. Well, that's true of any false document case. I mean, when you file a document with a court, we expect that the court's going to rely on that. And yet we have at least 8 cases that were cited to the panel that the board adopted saying, in those cases where you filed false documents, whether it's notarization or signing somebody else's name, given everything in the paradigm, a public reprimand is still appropriate.
But aren't those cases distinguishable? I mean, either the attorney got the client's permission or the attorney didn't file it with a court and instead filed it with, say, the city or filed it with somebody else. It seems like there's a major difference.
Many of them. I don't think all of them. And with all due deference, I'm not sure that I see the difference with whether you file a deed. I know one of the cases was a power of attorney case where the power of attorney didn't give the grandson to sell real estate, and the attorney went back and sort of made up a backdated power of attorney. Nobody questioned the motives of the grandson in wanting to sell the real estate, but I guess my point is that didn't get filed with a court, but it got filed with the recorder. And if you stop and think about it, what does the world become if lawyers file false documents, whether it's in the court or whether it's in the recorder's office where people have a right to go look and say, is this a legitimate transfer? Again, not in any way defending the conduct, but saying that that same type of conduct has, this once again, is not an outlier case. There are many cases where public reprimands have been imposed. I think a part of it also has to be, I agree with Mr. Thompson, and I think I said this in my reply to the objections, and I know I've said it in other cases before this court. The beauty of the discipline system in Ohio is that it is both predictable and unpredictable. It is unpredictable because we don't know what the result's going to be, because they are very tailored to the individual case. And they're predictable in the sense that the court does look at the individual facts of every case. There is, of course, a paradigm when you have these cases, because you've got all the factors involved, including, which I don't think has been mentioned, including the panel's own assessment of the relator. You know, when you sit there and listen to a guy who's brought down in front of the Supreme Court and has to sit there uncomfortably and talk about the things that he has done, you see it in the opinions. Even some of the cases that are cited in the briefs by the parties here, you see it where the lawyers still, when they're in front of the Board of Professional Conduct in a record hearing, still trying to make excuses and say, well, you know, my boss told me to have that affidavit signed, or whatever it is. And you don't have that in this case. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because I think it's important that the panel took that into account as well when they sized up the relator. A lot of my practice is criminal, and I liken it to those clients who have remorse because they got caught versus those clients who have remorse because of what they did. And I think that's one of the things that the panel has a right to, and indeed I think is charged by this court.
Is that what happened in this case? Because if the client had never discovered this dishonesty would have gone undiscovered.
This was, well, I'm not sure how to answer that, and I hope that this answer answers your question. It probably would have been discovered when all the final papers were seen. This was not an account. This was simply a waiver of an account, which actually his preference would have been to say, I need another extension because we're still gathering things. And so I guess my point, Justice Donnelly, is I think eventually when the account was filed, there's no evidence that he was trying to do anything, you know, underhanded with the assets. So I think eventually everybody would have seen it. I hope that answers your question about that.
But it's not a self-report.
It's not a self-report in the sense that when she called him up and fired him, he didn't go to the Bar Association, correct. But when the Bar Association called him, he didn't, you know, offer the myriad excuses that we've seen in, unfortunately, too many discipline cases.
But he could. He could have called
He could have called the Bar Association. There's no two ways about that. But I don't think even the relator is saying that he was not cooperative here.
That was a mitigating factor.
It is, and we have a disagreement, I guess, about the impact of that. They seem to say that, and I'm not sure that anything in Cameron specifically said, well, if the circumstances are right, as they were in Cameron and as they are here, little or no harm, and it's an isolated incident of misconduct, that you can step down from an actual suspension. I'm not sure that anything that was said in Cameron said, but that's the only thing you can do is step down to a stayed suspension. It seems to me that Cameron doesn't stand for that, and that this court has implicitly said so by the number of cases where it has authorized public reprimands for false document cases, including one that was pending at the time of our hearing, which this court has now decided, which is the Bush case, and including a case that was cited by us and cited as additional authority by the relator, which is the Billingsley case. So all of those cases still involve public reprimands, with the understanding that, yes, this is wrong, with the understanding that, yes, it is a bad thing and we have to send a message to the public, but we temper that because, and we read this time and time again, the primary purpose of the discipline system is to protect the public from lawyers who are doing untoward things. One of the available disciplines in that range is exactly what we have here. And so it seems to us a little bit curious because in terms of protection of the public, even the relator's not saying we have to protect the public by putting this guy out of circulation for a while.
Thank you.
We don't argue that their cases don't say what they say, and they don't argue that our cases don't say what they say. And so it seems to me that although the panel doesn't go into any great discussion of this, one of the things that I believe was in the record and I think was cited to us is one of the panel members cited the fact that this was the most impressive array of character references that he had seen for a long time. That, I think, says a lot. I know this court has always appropriately taken those character references seriously, and I think that's appropriate, and I think it's appropriate to consider in this case because, you know, I'm not a fan of lawyer advertising, probably because I'm old school, but they get up there and they tell you how wonderful they are because anybody can do that on a commercial. But what really tells you when somebody's a good lawyer is what their colleagues have to say about them. You know, when somebody calls me for a referral, I only refer them to lawyers that I myself would hire for that type of case. And I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is because I think the panel was obviously impressed with the particular amount of character evidence that there was in this case. And so I think on balance, the panel came down and said, this is a case where, yes, he did wrong. Yes, fortunately, nobody was harmed. Yes, he's never done anything like this before. He's truly remorseful. He's cooperated in these proceedings, and there's no reason to think that he's ever going to do this again, as evidenced by the fact that his colleagues have said so as well. In fact, there was one letter that I particularly recall from, I believe, a magistrate in Columbiana County who said, A, I'm very surprised that Brian did this, but B, I'm not very surprised that Brian was the first guy in there to admit responsibility and take responsibility for his actions.
Counsel, looking at all the cases, I asked your colleague same thing. How's this not the most analogous to Chodosh?
I looked at it again carefully after you asked that question. It seems to me there's a little bit more involved there because I think there was a situation where, in addition to the document falsification that had been done, I think there were some co-counsel situations that he did not disclose to the clients. I don't want to go outside the record on this, but I think the overall tenor of this estate administration was, and you'll see that the failure to communicate, or excuse me, failure to be diligent was dismissed in this case. So I think it's a fair reading that overall this client was informed. It's simply when this thing came up with this deadline and he panicked and signed those names. And I think that's different, Justice Fisher, from that case where he withheld the fact that there had been co-counsel. So, and I don't believe I have anything else unless the court has questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, 3 minutes, 4 seconds. I want to begin with, do you agree with your, both of you said learned colleagues, that there was overwhelming mitigation evidence by way of letters from a wide variety of individuals?
Yes, it was great. I agree completely. I don't.
What was most compelling?
Both the quantity and the people who had written the letters. I don't recall reviewing them in great detail. We never do anything but stipulate the character letters, but there's a stack. I want to say there's like 24. And I recall they are people who also impress me, many of them. You know, we have a relatively small legal community. There may be 1,000 of us between the 3 neighboring counties. We know each other for the most part. It's very impressive character mitigation evidence, no question about it. I agree completely.
Why is a public reprimand not enough to protect the public in this particular case?
Because the distinctions that you draw, the messaging that you send with these lower sanctions matter. You know, fairly or unfairly, a public reprimand sends a message to the lawyers of Ohio, this is not so bad. You know, it's the lowest form of discipline. What messaging it does to the public, does the public ever understand the distinction between a public reprimand and a fully state suspension? Absolutely not.
They know they're both bad, and it's on the lawyer's permanent record.
They do, right. Yeah, they're 2 bad things. Mm-hmm. That lawyer did something bad. That's all the public perceives. But we know the difference, other lawyers. And, you know, our duty to protect the public includes the deterrent effect of discipline. Now, I want to reemphasize that I do not believe, Relator does not believe, firmly does not believe, that Brian McCullough deserves an actual suspension. And actually, there's a detail in Chodosh. My learned colleague is correct. There is a bit more in Chodosh. I wrote down other non-analogous misconduct here. Can't offer more detail than that. But there's other stuff in that case that doesn't fit squarely within our discussion today. And in that case, there's a direct quotation that the court noted, or I wrote down a direct quotation, the court noted a policy at that point. And Chodosh is 2019. A policy of imposing fully stayed suspensions in cases involving isolated incidents of dishonesty and an abundance of mitigating evidence. I mean, I think there's some recognition in Chodosh, and I apologize, I don't remember who the author of the opinion is, that we have shifted, you know, that we don't necessarily, as the Chief Justice alluded to, have to start with Feuerbach and depart, but that we have evolved a bit. And slippery slope arguments are always a bit of a fallacy, but we don't want to keep evolving to the point where conduct like this is a public reprimand, or we lower the bar. And I think that's the answer to your question. We need to keep the bar for conduct like this a bit elevated. You know, we need to have that level of protection. And then finally, Billingsley is a public reprimand case that I also think answers your question, because in Billingsley, there's a bit of dicta, or a dictum, at the end. Where, yes, this is wrongful conduct that Attorney Billingsley did, but it's not like she forged a signature. You know, it's a distinction that's drawn sort of in passing in Billingsley, but that's why we quoted it as additional authority, that, hey, this is a public reprimand because, in part, she didn't do this additional thing. Well, this respondent did. It doesn't take him to the point of actual time off, but it should take him to a fully stayed suspension. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, would you close the court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.